Or a couple letters, I don't know.
You certainly may. The court is being joined by Judge Irwin of the Court of Appeals. I think everybody's in and out now, so you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice, ladies and gentlemen. My name is James Martin Davis. I'm an attorney for Tyler Bain. I am out of Omaha, Nebraska. What we're doing here is appealing the conviction and a sentence of the conviction of Tyler Bain for first-degree sexual assault, second-degree assault, terroristic threats, and kidnapping. This was a prosecution in Broken Bow, Custer County. We're appealing as to both the convictions and the sentence. Mr. Tyler Bain is spending the rest of his life in the penitentiary for the kidnapping charge and several others. Now, I've raised several issues in the brief. We hardly call it a brief. It was 50 pages long. 20 minutes is hardly enough time. So I'm going to submit argument two as it relates to the life sentence on the kidnapping. I want to address arguments 1A and 1B. But I'm going to address argument 1B first. That relates to the appointment of my client's initial defense attorney. My client was arrested November 9, 2011, and from November of that year to March of the next, he was represented by a retained counsel named Rodney Palmer. Now, during this period, there established an attorney-client relationship between the two of them. There was communications, there was correspondence, there was multiple meetings, they took depositions, and Mr. Palmer had a file. Now, on March of 2012, my client ran out of money. So he wanted the court to appoint Rodney Palmer as his attorney to continue to represent him. Well, the prosecutor objected to that. And because of what happened in two hearings, the judge committed two major mistakes. At the time, then, and now, there's a statute that says 29-3904, subsection 2, in selecting counsel to represent an indigent felony defendant, the prosecuting attorney shall not have any role whatsoever in the selection or appointment of counsel by the court, including but not limited to any individual appointment assignments. That was the law then, it's the law now, and so the court completely ignored that. Asked the prosecutor to be heard on two different hearings. Well, I object. You know, our county can't afford it. This man lives 100 miles away. We don't want to pay for it. Secondly, he misrepresented the law to the court. He said there's case law that says you can't appoint as an attorney somebody who was your previous attorney when you ran out of money. That's nonsense.
Now, who represented Bain at that point?
That was Mr. Palmer was still there.
All right. Shouldn't somebody objected at that time?
Should somebody have
objected to what the county attorney was doing? I guess my point is, what is the remedy now after it's happened?
Well, I'm saying what that does is lead to what happened next.
Okay.
The remedy is, there's one remedy I'm going to talk about at the end, okay. And I think you know what's coming there. But with respect to that, you know, the judge shouldn't have. You know, that was a mistake by the judge. The prosecutor got involved, and so that caused... Had they not been concerned with the cost and appointed Rodney Palmer, we wouldn't be here, and we wouldn't have this colossal mess up in terms of what happened later on.
What difference would another attorney have made as opposed to Rodney Palmer continuing as his lawyer for his defense?
Because Rodney Palmer was never... my client's file would have been intact, and it would never be disclosed to the prosecutors.
Your point being that it's the transfers of the files, actually maybe on both sides, that leads to this cascade of the revelation of confidential stuff.
Yeah, one right after another.
Okay.
I mean, you know, if I gave you a glass of water and oil, how do you separate the oil from the water? And that's what we're talking about here.
So your point is the judge should have, on sui sponte, held a hearing.
Well, she had two hearings.
No, held a hearing on what was given and the effect of that and had witnesses.
Yeah, that was later on. I mean, we're still at the early stages, but when she, instead of appointing Palmer, she looks in the courtroom and says, any lawyers here? Oh, there's Mr. Bowers. You want to take this case? So she appoints Mr. Bowers. All right, Mr. Bowers gets together with his client. He puts together a defense file. He meets with this client. He gets a defense theory. He gets a list of witnesses. He gets a defense statement or version of the events. And then he is my client's new defense attorney. 5 minutes late, 5 months later, he's appointed county attorney. Now he my client's second defense attorney, becomes his prosecutor. And so what Bauer does is he puts in a motion to withdraw. Okay, the judge grants it. All right. Now you have to understand, Mr. Bauer now has two files: my client's defense file and the prosecutor's file. Now they appoint the attorney general as the special prosecutor.
That's Lerman.
Yeah. Matt is appointed. And so what happens is they send the whole file down to the attorney general's office. All right. Matt's got it. And what does he see? Oh my gosh. The defense file's in here.
Do we know what the confidential information was?
Well, yeah, based on what they're saying, it was defense trial strategy and correspondence and you know, again, we don't know exactly each and every document, but we have two lawyers that withdrawing in this case, Matt Lerman and then Ms. Homolka later on. Ms. Homolka, what she tells the court is she tells the court, because she had to withdraw later, she says that Matt tells the court, the file is received contained confidential attorney-client privileged documents and communications. He's seen them and read them. The documents were clearly privileged communication and secrets between Palmer and Bauer. So he says the documents are commingled. And then Homolka is even more.
Let's see. So how do you remedy this? Would this be to have another prosecutor appointed? You have no access to any of the documents in question so that he wouldn't know what the strategy was going to be?
Well, at this time, it's not a question of who. It's a question of what. That prosecutor's file is now contaminated. It has a virus. You know, it's been exposed to Ebola. And how in the world do you cure that? Like I say, how are you
going to appoint a prosecutor that has no access to any of the file that was belonged to the defendant?
Well, how do you know that? I mean,
by a judge conducting a hearing, which was not done.
That's right. The judge should have done that initially. And instead of what she does, Homolka tells the court how bad it is. She calls the counsel for discipline, and he allows her. He says, "No, you got to withdraw." Here's what she said: "I did find what I suspected to be confidential statements and general communications that reveal, among other things, what I believe is the defense trial strategy."
But Mr. Davis, the state argues that you didn't raise the Sixth Amendment. How did you raise this, and did you have to raise it?
I don't. It's prejudicial error. I mean, this is plain error. I mean, if you'll cite the cases, I have the particularly one from Connecticut.
Well, it's plain error. You still have to raise it, don't you?
Excuse me?
You still have to raise the error, don't you?
Well, how can he? He didn't know. Again, with respect to this, when you say that you have a prosecutor, again, saying that she wants to withdraw, again, that's sui sponte. Sui sponte means they got to do it on their own. It doesn't mean that we have to tell them how. We can't tell a judge how to judge. We can make objections to evidence and whatever, but when something like this happens, this is a massive...
When Homolka comes to see this conflict or potential conflict in September of 13,
yes,
right? And the trial is in February of 14... So what steps, if any, were taken at the trial level to sort this out and ask for a remedy?
I don't know what was done between...
Between September, right? Because now, between September and February, this issue was known to some of the players.
Yeah, that's right.
Was it known to the court?
Well,
was the court asked to do something?
Well, I don't know that the court was asked to do anything at all, but what I'm saying is...
Well, the court did do something because they asked Homolka to purge the file.
Yeah, so now all of a sudden the person that was prosecuting my client is all of a sudden now trying to protect him. I mean, we had a saying in the Army called FUBAR, and I'm not going to find it.
Well, let me ask you this. From this record, can we know that Marsh never, the eventual prosecutor, received any communications about Bain's trial strategy?
No, because can
we know whether the previous prosecutors had conveyed Bain's trial strategy to investigators or potential witnesses from this file?
What we know is that he got the prosecutor's file, and what I'm saying is whether there's any direct communications from my client to his two other lawyers, that file was contaminated.
But Justice Connolly's referring to this continuum after Homolka sees a conflict. Homolka's asked to sort this, right, and clean it up, and then deliver it to Marsh. So do we know if that was satisfactory so that Marsh would have received an uncontaminated file?
You know, I've gone through this record. I don't know that the record shows she delivered it to Marsh. I mean, as I understand, I don't know what happened after that.
Well, she didn't deliver it to Marsh. She delivered it. It eventually was delivered to
Potter.
Potter, the defense attorney.
Potter to look at, is that right?
And he was satisfied that there wasn't any, correct me if I'm wrong, didn't he say it was okay? The file, whatever they had was okay. But he didn't know what was given previously, if anything, to investigators or how they used this.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the oil and water, because that file, as it goes down, becomes contaminated, because as they're working on it, They know what the defense is going to do. It's not just the documents; it's the intermingling. Which contaminates the whole prosecution, and the virus kept spreading. And how do you cure that? And you know, you can't put the burden on this guy here, you know, lives out in the country, to know what's happening with his defense files.
Is this similar to a Castigar hearing in the federal system where they have to have a hearing and show that the evidence and the witnesses have not been tainted by
somewhat,
an unfair prosecution?
Yeah, it's the idea of the Chinese wall. Because, you know, when a prosecutor goes to a law firm or whatever, or becomes a defense attorney, or a defense attorney becomes a prosecutor, he's not disqualified from doing certain things, but they set up a Chinese wall. We didn't have a Chinese wall here. We had a Chinese fire drill. From all bam, 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 all the way down.
So Potter's looking at this as of no significance?
Excuse me?
Potter's looking after Homolka is of no significance in your view?
How do you mean? I'm not sure of your question.
But I'm trying to see if your client was protected at some point along the way, notwithstanding the absence of some formal event.
I don't know. That he was prosecuted by an individual who inherited a tainted file. Okay, just because they gave things back doesn't mean it's not tainted.
Well, I mean, Potter just looked at the file. He had no knowledge as to what or how this information was disseminated to investigators, whether it was used to prepare witnesses or anything like that.
Exactly. I mean, it spread. I mean, it was like a virus. You can't say, okay, this is infected and this is not, and we're going to take the virus out here and give it back to you, because those documents, twice now, contaminated the prosecutor's file, because the prosecutor continued to work on these
cases.
Well,
then your view would be the prosecutor's team infects the prosecutor's team, not just the file.
Well, yeah, it's not just the team, but it's the documents that they use. It's their strategy.
Okay.
It's their actions. It's their ideas. You know, because that's poison. As soon as they see that, I mean, if you've got any regard for the Sixth Amendment and you read these cases, you understand
Would you move on, because you're kind of limited in time here, to the mitigating factors?
Yes. I had some rebuttal time. You want me to do that now, Judge? What we're saying with respect to this is my client should have never gotten life. I mean, in terms of the statute, the serious bodily injury. There was an expert testifies there wasn't, and she looked at the pictures and made a determination, well, yeah, there is. But the statute talks about being released or liberated alive by the defendant in a safe place. This is her own house, without having suffered serious bodily injury. And I'm thinking, you look at the record in this case, and there wasn't necessarily serious bodily injury.
Counsel, how do you describe a sexual assault?
Excuse me?
Was she sexually assaulted?
He was convicted.
That's not serious bodily injury to a person?
Well, I don't think that was considered by the court.
Isn't seriously bodily injury defined under the statute as, bodily injury which involves a substantial risk of death, or which involves substantial risk of serious permanent disfigurement?
Yes.
Or protracted loss of impairment of the function or any part of the organ of the body?
Exactly.
Was there any medical testimony as to qualify under that definition?
I think there was medical testimony that she wasn't serious bodily injury, and at the trial, I think.
But you have to get over a couple other hurdles, too, that it
was
voluntary release.
She was in her own house, and so he left. After it was over, he left, and she stayed there. She didn't call 911.
Did she have any means of transportation or communication until the postman arrived?
Yeah, she had a telephone. I think there was tractors or other vehicles there. Not their cars, but I mean, she didn't call any. She didn't call 911. Didn't call the sheriff. Didn't try to leave. And when she didn't have the mailman call 911. She didn't have the mailman take her to the police station. Took her to her cousins or her nephews or nieces or something. I can't remember exactly who it was. But so he left and she was in a safe place. That's hardly. Felony 1A kidnapping.
Well, he went out and got the dog and brought the dog back, didn't he?
Yeah. And so, I mean, she, at no time in those first few hours afterwards, did anything at all. I mean, she was free. She was released. This isn't one of these hostage kind of kidnappings where, you know, somebody's bound and gagged and held for ransom. That's what the statute imagines, but...
You think it would require a physical detention. Is that your view of the statute?
Well, I mean, that certainly it leans in that direction. If it's a physical situation where she's prevented from leaving, either by threats or whatever, then, you know, that's more in tune
that's
with...
That's the easy case.
Yeah. And it seems to me this is not so difficult when, you know, you look at the facts. She's in her own house. He's gone. You know, I mean. So, what do we mean by release?
I'm asking a different question.
Yes,
in
ma'am.
Terms of free to leave if you're not physically restrained.
Yeah, I don't
Can
know.
Can you be free to leave from a psychological standpoint, or must there be evidence to show you're not psychologically free to leave?
Well, there has to be some objective. Evidence that there was a threat that if you leave, I'm going to kill you, or I'm going to do it, but you have to stay here. But there's no evidence of that. I mean, he left, and you know, and she was in her own house from the beginning to the end. I mean, I don't know how you would turn that into a kidnapping. Basically, what this was, I mean, he says the sex was voluntary. This was a domestic violence case that accelerated all the way up to a 1A felony. I mean, and that's basically what it was, because he testified, how she was inebriated. They've had these problems before. You know, the fight was over alcohol, and I only have a minute left for rebuttal, so...
Thank you very much, Mr. Smith. Good morning.
Good morning. Police Court, I'm James D. Smith, appearing on behalf of the appellee, the state of Nebraska in this case. The record on what the judge did as far as how the judge handled the, what I don't think there's any dispute, is an inadvertent disclosure of privileged material.
Do we know what it is?
We don't know what it is.
If we would have had a hearing, we'd know. And how far it was disseminated.
If we had a hearing, I would agree. I would expect, depending on what happened at the hearing, we would know. What the judge did in this case was upon being, standard law on when privileged material is inadvertently produced to the other side is that it's to be returned to the party who properly had it. What happened in this case was the judge did order the prosecutor to provide whatever the privileged material was that she had back to current counsel Potter, and then directed counsel Potter, who's then representing the defendant, advises counsel to contact the court for in-camera hearing if we've got any remaining dispute, essentially, about this issue.
Justice Conley and Mr. Davis were exploring is we don't know other dissemination. In other words, Mr. Potter could look at that file, but what he wouldn't be informed of is what the team had seen.
Well, the court's order is for Potter to retain all of the confidential or privileged information. And Potter, who's defendant's counsel, would have had an obligation, at least under the court's order, if there's any dispute, such as, have you got all the information? Is there an issue on this? Has the defendant perhaps been denied Sixth Amendment right of counsel? I would submit it would be under the circumstances of this case, it would have been up to Potter.
But Potter would not have known, just looking at what was given to him, what had been disseminated to and to whom by just looking at the file.
We don't know what Potter did from this record. This record, we don't know if Potter, what communication.
That's the fault here, because the judge should have conducted a hearing.
I don't know that the judge should conduct a hearing when the judge becomes aware of it. Remedy is provide the confidential material back to defense counsel, appoints a new prosecutor who, under the theory, should not have any of the taint because of the court's order, and counsel, who then represents the defendant, if has an issue about this, I would submit it to
the counsel. I don't want to belabor this, but Marsh doesn't know whether this confidential information was used by investigators to go out and interview witnesses or anything like that.
We don't know that, but he does have counsel. Counsel, if there is a concern, at least under the judge's order, I would submit it would be incumbent on counsel to file a motion. If there's an issue about there is some taint, how this has been used, I'm not comfortable that I've received everything. He didn't do that.
Do you have case law or other supportive a supportive source for what you're telling us?
What I would submit to supportive source is if you're going to assert a constitutional claim of being denied a constitutional right, it would be incumbent on you to raise that issue to the court if you're concerned that the court's order is not sufficient.
But he did raise it. He brought to the attention that everybody knew that there was confidential information had been disseminated. And so your point is he should have specifically raised the Sixth Amendment violation while the court knew this was going on, and then had Homolka look at the file. So the court was aware, and don't you think it was raised?
I would submit when he's got counsel, and counsel is perfectly capable of doing whatever investigation, whatever follow-up, whatever he wants to do to say, we still have a problem here. I would submit it's up to counsel to raise that issue. We don't know what Potter did to satisfy himself. As far as we know, Potter thoroughly investigated the matter. He was satisfied that I got everything back. Marsh doesn't have anything. We don't have a problem here. There's no issue going forward.
Well, I don't think he investigated. I think the Bill of Exceptions shows that he said to the court in a colloquy, I looked at the file, and I don't see anything there or something there.
We know he said that, but we don't know that's all he did up until the time of trial. We really don't know that. We don't know what depositions were taken. We don't know if a week before trial he's still pursuing this, he's still checking it out. We don't know what questions he's asking during depositions to satisfy himself. I think what we do know, he's aware of it. He's got counsel. The court's been ordered, if you've got anything further involving this issue, bring it back to the court. We're going to have an in-camera hearing on it. It was really put on defense counsel, who, frankly, I would think would have a duty, if there's a concern, investigate it, follow through with it, check it out. If it's coming up during depositions or whatever, because I don't know that just having an in-camera hearing resolves all of that, because the in-camera hearing doesn't necessarily mean that we know.
You call all the witnesses, and all the investigators, and you call all the lawyers, and then there's cross-examination, and then you find out what, if anything's been disseminated.
I would submit calling all of the witnesses listed on the information was not something that the judge has some duty to sua sponte do that. I think it's up to defense counsel, because the defense is the one that inadvertently provided this to the prosecution. It wasn't anything that the government did anything wrong. It was something that the defense did erroneously, provided to the prosecution. He's got counsel who has a duty to represent the defendant, would be thoroughly capable of investigating that issue. And if there's a concern, file the motion, raise it to the court, create a record. He didn't do that. Now, if counsel was not effective, that's a separate issue.
In short, are you saying there's a preservation of error problem? Is that?
Well, I think it's a preservation of error problem as far as he didn't raise it to the trial court. And so now he's raising it for the first time on appeal with an out-of-record.
What's the literature say about who has the burden in this type of situation where confidential information has been breached?
I would submit it's on the defendant when he has counsel, when he's aware of it, and the defense created the problem. Prosecution didn't create the problem. This isn't bad conduct by the prosecution. This is actually good conduct by the prosecution, who becomes aware of it, brings it to the attention of the court, and it's a defense problem that the court, I'd say, did the adequate remedy, provide what we have back to the defense. And if you still have concerns, if there are concerns, file your motion, bring it up to the court. There was plenty of time to do that. That didn't happen. We don't know from this record exactly what Potter did or did not do.
But are you familiar with case law that requires in a constitutional violation of confidential information that the court must sui sponte have an in-camera hearing?
I'm not aware of the Nebraska's got any requirement on that. I would submit in this circumstance, I don't know that really addresses it when it's what I would call an inadvertent release of confidential information. I think it's different if you have the issue of the government engaging in some misconduct, such as they're doing the eavesdropping, they're putting the undercover person in there, in which there's an issue of the government's misconduct that may have deprived the defendant of Sixth Amendment right. To me, when it's the defendant's own error that created the problem, to say that the court must do some type of a broad inquiry, I would submit as misplaced, because if it is what we have is inadvertent release of privileged information to the prosecutor gives it back. That's what we have. You have counsel appointed. You got your information back. If you still have a concern, the court's willing to hear it. And counsel, it's not as if counsel is just a potted plant sitting in the corner. Counsel's got a duty to represent the defendant. And if there is a concern, by whatever means he does to investigate it, to find out, check it out, bring it back to the court, and he does have a duty to check it out.
Do you think there's any case law that when there's been this sort of inadvertent disclosure, that there's any presumption that arises that it's been shared by other members of the prosecution team other than the individual to whom it directly went to?
I don't think there's any basis for any presumption when the presumption starts off with what do we know, and in this case, what we know is the prosecution represents, I got this, I found out, I brought it to the attention of the court. I don't know how you could take that as a presumption and say that I bring it to the attention of the court and you should somehow presume that the prosecutor, upon becoming aware of it and bring it to the attention of the court, went and made 50 copies and sent it out to law enforcement.
Well, that's the problem. We don't know because there wasn't a hearing and nobody was under oath.
There wasn't a hearing, but I would submit, again, my argument is, who's got the obligation when the defense essentially screws up?
Maybe the court, when it's aware of this.
Frankly, I don't think even if the court has a hearing, I think the hearing is still going to fall short because it's going to depend upon one's got counsel, counsel's got some duty to find out, investigate, check it out. How is the court just on its own going to know? I think it's more of a presumption. Defense counsel pointed duty to check it out, duty to investigate, and if counsel is finding anything, that person should be bringing it to the attention of the court. Counsel finds out nothing and becomes aware of nothing, and there's nothing to reflect any taint on what we've got. Counsel says, I'm totally satisfied. I would submit record should be sufficient for counsel to say, I don't see any reason we have to waste the court's time on this any further. But later turns out counsel was ineffective in what he did. That's an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. But to me, the concept that you have to have a hearing, and if you don't have a hearing, or if the hearing's not good enough, that the defense gets a dismissal, frankly, encourages defense attorneys to be providing stuff to the prosecution.
No, I see it differently. I see if it's the other way around, if the trial court abrogates the duty to have a hearing, then anything goes.
I don't think the court abrogated having a hearing. The court indicated is perfectly willing to have a hearing. Come back and tell me what you've got that we're going to have a hearing on beyond what we've got so far. It's not that the court says, gee, I'm not going to listen to this anymore. I've satisfied it's done. The court said, I'm perfectly willing to have a hearing.
But do you agree that Potter knew that just by looking and making that statement that he knew if and how far this information had been disseminated?
From that isolated comment, that's all we know that Potter knew as of that time. We don't know what he knew later.
But I'm asking that question. Do you think that he knew at that time?
I don't know what Potter knew at that time. I know what his comment is.
Could you address the kidnapping issue?
Sure. On the kidnapping issue, the statute, to me it's a mitigation issue. The statute requires three elements for the mitigation. One is that the victim was voluntarily released in a safe place, and without having suffered serious bodily injury.
Any facts to support that she was not freely released and suffered serious bodily injury as defined by the statute?
The district court found that the victim did suffer serious bodily injury and she was not voluntarily released.
But wouldn't you need some medical testimony to determine whether, that under that definition, all she had was the pictures of the victim with her eyes swollen. There's no broken bones. There's just no other testimony. Other than Okoya, who testified at trial, that said these were not life-threatening.
Well, the statute.
And I understand the judge doesn't have to take that as true.
Yeah, it's bodily injury that involves a substantial risk of serious permanent disfigurement. That's the judge's finding. Bodily injury, she sexually assaulted.
What is the permanent impairment that she's sustained from the alleged injury?
The statute is substantial risk. It's not that you actually have to have suffered. It's a substantial.
Are you including the rape in there as a substantial risk?
The sexual assault, to me, would be what one would have to be looking at is the bodily injury that's a substantial risk of serious permanent disfigurement. If this court wanted to say that there is not a substantial risk of essentially serious permanent disfigurement bodily injury from a person being raped, I guess the court could say that. I would submit I would disagree, and I think most victims of sexual assault
would disagree. Do you know what the cases elsewhere say about this connection between intimate partner violence and kidnapping?
I'm not sure where the court's going with that one.
Well, I'm looking at the first element on voluntary release.
Yeah, I don't think the court even has to go to the serious bodily injury because the voluntary released
or right.
In a kidnapping in this situation, we have, after she's been assaulted, he's taken her, he's basically made her a prisoner in her own home, tells her, I'm going to lock you in the trunk of the car when I leave, and the only reason he doesn't is because she promises I won't leave, and when she, what I would submit, escapes, he doesn't tell her she's free to go. He's told her, I'm going to put you in the trunk of the car unless you agree to stay here, and she promises to stay here. So that's the only reason he doesn't put her in the trunk. He leaves her there, essentially a captive in her own home. And when you look at her escape, it's not a release. It's an escape plan for the mailman to save her, and the escape is not from a safe place. The escape is from her home. Because the home is not a safe place. The guy's taken her car. He's taken her cell phone. As far as what he's told her, you better stay here. This is where I've raped you. This is where I beat you up. This is where I've taken you. Essentially, you're a captive in your own home, and there is no voluntary release. There is an escape plan to get out of her home, which is not a safe place. And the mailman is the one who saves her because she puts the flag up on the mailbox so that when she sees the mailman come by and stop, she escapes from the place, which is, I would submit, not a safe place, her home, where she's been a captive, and gets out. So it's not a voluntary release. It's an escape. She had to come up with a plan to get out of there, and she was, frankly, a captive in her home where she'd been beaten up and raped with the guy. Her expectation is he's coming back, because if it's a voluntary release, why is he saying, he'll put you in the trunk of the car when I'm gone, and the only reason he doesn't is because she agrees to stay there. That's not a voluntary release.
So your view is that it's not a voluntary release, and that ends the inquiry?
Not under the circumstances of this case. It's anything but. This is a person who was a kidnapped victim who was being essentially held hostage in her own home. By a person who was going to come back. And as the judge said, that during and after the assaults, he made threats to her that the victim reasonably believed were viable. I would submit any victim in that case would believe those threats were viable after what he did to her about he's coming back.
What were the physical injuries?
Your Honor?
What were the physical injuries that were?
Physical injuries were exceptionally bruises from being beat. It was what I would call the injury from being sexually assaulted. And I guess if the court wants to say, again, I would say, if a person being sexually assaulted who's got been bodily injured, and if the court wants to say that's not a substantial risk of serious permanent disfigurement or injury, I don't know if the court wants to say that. I think that would probably get a reaction that probably would not. I just don't know if the court wants to go there, especially when you can do one of the other two elements. Victim wasn't voluntarily released, not in a safe place. Either one of those elements are clearly there. I don't know if the court has to address the suffered serious bodily injury.
An intruder breaks into a house, rapes the occupant, tells her to stay there while he leaves, and he leaves and he's gone. Is that a kidnapping also?
I would say that the person's still being held hostage there, especially when that person...
Because he says you stay there.
Yeah, you stay there, and as far as she knows, he's coming back, and he took her car, took her cell phone, took her communication, and he resided there too. So he's coming back. He's coming back unless she gets out of there. So it's not as if go to the grocery store or wherever you want. He's held hostage in that home. I guess I'm out of time. Unless the court has other questions, we would ask that the judgment be affirmed.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
He has a minute and 22.
A minute and 22 seconds.
Thank you. Mr. Palmer could not give that file a clean bill of health. How could he know that?
You mean Mr. Potter?
Mr. Potter couldn't give that file a clean bill of health. When somebody is exposed to Ebola, everybody who has contact with that has to be treated. And so how can Mr. Potter say that, well, yeah, it's okay? He had no inclination, no idea how it was used, how it was contaminated, how it was disseminated. You know, only a doctor can tell how far it spread, and even then they can make a
Do we know on this record that he does not know those things?
Excuse me?
Do we know on this record that he does not know those things?
Whether we know or not, how could he know? What I'm saying is that's you can assume that happened in those files. That's how cases progress. When somebody looks at it, those prosecutor's files continue to be billed.
But you're saying based on what we know in life, this is how it works. The prosecutor will reach out to his or her team to do stuff.
When a virus is there, you don't know how far it's going to spread, but you know the virus is there.
Was it Mr. Potter's obligation to make that inquiry? Did the judge place that responsibility on him?
No. I mean, I think they just asked him, were these your documents? Did you get them all back? Okay, here's the germs, but you don't know who's contaminated. You know, I mean, I think I want to read this one thing before I finish in terms of this Lazar case. We agree with the courts that have held that the burden is not on the defendant to establish that he was prejudiced when the prosecutor had intruded on attorney-client communications that contained information concerning the defendant's trial strategy. Rather, because the disclosure of such information is inherently prejudicial, prejudice should be presumed, regardless of whether the invasion of the attorney-client privilege was intentional. The subjective intent of the government and the identity of the party responsible for disclosure simply has no bearing on that question. Based on that, I'm going to ask you to reverse and dismiss.
Thank you very much. That takes us to the next case of the day, which is State versus Timothy J. Britt. I am recused from this matter. Justice Wright will preside. The court will be joined by Judge Bishop from the Court of Appeals and Judge Irwin, who is already out on the bench.